After the game was over, Henrik interviewed the participants to see what they'd been thinking.
Hello, my name is Hazel Marlinwood. I'm speaking on behalf of the Peterborough chapter of Hoops International to tell you that you're listening to Trent Radio 92.7 FM, quality programming for the Peterborough community. Oh, turn that music down, please. It's hurting my ears. Turn that music down. Excuse me, I said that was hurting my ears. For the love of God, turn that down. Turn that down.
You have been listening to Jam with Manlisher, or Dog Bites Manlisher. I'm the host, Pilot K9, and I was jamming today with Porter Hall, Really Happening, and Go Go Godot. Well, this is the studio tour, and I haven't had any visitors in about 45 minutes. So, I hope more people will come on down to Trent Radio at 715 George Street at Park Hill and check out the visual art and the audio art. I'm still hoping somebody's going to show up and jam with me. Right now, though, do you want to start this? Do you want to start the interview?
Why don't we go off into something so we can give Iga a call? What Brian is talking about is that Iga Jenik down at ArtSpace has some things to say. And so we're going to give her a call in a few minutes and have a discussion with her. But before we do that, we're going to put some sounds going so that we can give her a call and get her prepped and everything rolling.
Okay.
And Brian is pummeling through his maze of sounds.
I think I found something.
Good.
Thank you.
Iga, are you there? You are there. Hold on a sec. I'm getting an extra amount of stuff going on here. Okay, hold on. Sorry, folks. We're having slight technical difficulties.
Turn the phone up higher than the microphone.
Okay. There we go. Iga, are you there?
I am here.
You are there. Okay, folks, we're here for another season of Art Space Noise Space, and for this episode, we're going to be talking with Iga about ordinary Canadians in the arts. So there was a big meeting at Art Space on Wednesday night.
Yeah.
You want to fill us in on that?
Well, we called a public meeting on the issues of arts and culture in this upcoming election to sort of answer the public's outcry about what's been going on. We've been having emails and conversations with many members in our community about how drastic of a measure this was by the government just prior to announcing the election. So we presented a bunch of options and came up with strategies on how to try and tackle the Conservative government in this election as an arts community. But it extends sort of to larger social and well-being issues. But from the 50-person group meeting attended by some media and the Liberal candidates, we put together a structure, and we are the Ordinary Canadians, following a lot of the kind of work that the Department of Culture has been doing.
Okay.
We've decided to affiliate ourselves with this nationwide movement to talk about the future of this country and what culture contributes to it and how it's trying to be unraveled and undermined by certain policies. Mm-hmm. And yeah, as of Monday, we'll be launching a campaign, I suppose, for the votes coming in on the 14th.
Right. Yeah, I mean, in some ways, it's good timing.
Well, yes.
Now, what are some of the strategies that have been sort of talked about?
Well, the very idea is to utilize our means as artists and organizations with the kind of resources that we have to stage a lot of sort of public events and information tools. You know, we've put out a flyer to this weekend's openings at Arts Week, and the studio tour, one of the first communications. We're sending out a press release on Monday. There are a number of national strategies going on. Gone in 30 Seconds is a call for videos, exactly 30 seconds, about people's reactions to it. And this is a fantastic way to get involved and send this in, both to the Department of Culture. We'll be hosting it here at ArtSpace, sort of giving a couple of days of room for people to shoot their own in the back if they don't have their own access. But it's part of the national campaign. October 9th is This Is Not a Conservative Party Night across the country. So if anybody out there is doing events on October 9th, make sure to call it This Is Not a Conservative Party, unless you support them, and who would, really? So there are a whole bunch of different activities going on. We'll be linking up with a lot of these national movements and a lot of the press, a lot of the commentary that goes on around it. It's sort of, you know, one of the larger issues now in the election. Nobody assumed that it would ever have any kind of drive and force, but it's become a much bigger issue than just some money to a couple of programs, if this is what they're claiming.
Right. Well, and I think that, that's where, again, it's somewhat good timing in that hopefully we can actually raise awareness and turn this possible negative into a positive with getting people to realize how important the arts are.
Well, we got 2 weeks now,
yep.
A little more than that, and it is part of the bigger problem is that a lot of people don't really understand what arts are, what culture is. And, you know, a lot of the issues around these funding cuts lately has been the government's you know, position on the fact that they've actually increased the funding when
right.
all it is, it's been shuffled and arts has been categorically mm-hmm. cut off from any of these programs that they've been maybe looking at. But,
yeah.
you know, we're investing into sports and social services, which is fantastic,
mm-hmm.
but you cannot not include culture in all of those arguments.
Right. Well, and I think that that's one of the strategies of the conservative government in particular is to pit us against each other, if they can, where, you know, all of us kind of at the bottom end of the funding structures end up having to squabble over the little pennies they throw us, right?
Yeah.
Now, you were mentioning earlier today to me something that ArtSpace is doing with the show that's up right now.
Yes. We've decided to postpone our planned exhibitions for the week after the elections and spend the next 2 weeks focusing on what we have here in the most creative kind of ways that we possibly can, hence a lot of video, hence a lot of theater that hopefully will be happening.
Mm-hmm.
And since we have this installation in-house, taking care of business by Emily Mann, and I imagine a lot of people listening in Peterborough have seen it.
Mm-hmm.
It's over 10,000 individual post-it notes on four walls of the gallery, representing a very banal office spaces of the 9-to-5 economy and working mm-hmm. mode. So this falls very conveniently at the end of the exhibition that we should be in this Ordinary Canadians campaign talking about art. And this is sort of the reverse end of it.
Mm-hmm.
But provided Emini agrees, and I can't imagine that he wouldn't,
mm-hmm.
our campaign from ArtSpace will be to disseminate all the post-its that we have on the wall through collecting people's signatures who support our mandate, and the Made of Ordinary Canadians, to pay a dollar and sign one of the post-its, and we will mail it to Mr. Harper's office
mm-hmm.
so that he can receive an actual full exhibition, provided nobody throws them out, and God knows.
Right.
I
think they're required to do something with stuff that they receive.
I hope so, because mm. if this campaign really takes off, and I can't imagine it wouldn't,
mm-hmm.
is, you know, to send this really extravagant sort of exhibition that's very minimal and so useless
mm-hmm.
when it's taken down in 10,000 pieces. So, you know, maybe he could reconstruct it somewhere.
Right. Now, if anybody that's listening out there is interested, what should they do?
We'll be kicking this off as an official campaign early in the week,
mm-hmm.
and the exhibition ends at the end of this week officially, and that's when we will kick into mode with
mm-hmm.
All of the campaigns going on from here and around us.
Right.
So stay tuned for official information.
Cool.
About the Mr. Harper posted campaign.
Mm-hmm. Well, and then of course people can stop in at ArtSpace at any point and get information.
Absolutely.
Yeah. During gallery hours. And we're at, 378?
378 Elmer,
yeah.
just south of Hunter Street.
Mm-hmm.
And we're open Tuesday to Saturday, 12 to 6 and
cool.
4 on Saturdays.
Cool. Okay. So now, is there anything else up your sleeve down there?
Well, October 4th is the closing of Arts Week, and
mm-hmm.
we'll be hosting an event sort of affiliated with this posted campaign.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a good time to come out.
Cool.
And that weekend, a lot of the under 30 seconds will be happening. So as of Tuesday, there's a lot of that for anybody who is interested to figure out, to know more about the art cuts and social services cuts. We have a ton of information streaming in. All that is posted. And until the 14th, we're doing what we can to be sort of vocal about the impact that this will have on
mm-hmm.
our community if
mm-hmm.
conservatives continue to maintain their views the way they are, because this is such a bigger issue than, you know, the $45 million or...
Right, yes.
This is the principle.
There's something systematic at work that needs to be challenged.
Yes, and yeah. we cannot afford this government, not
mm-hmm.
just as artists, but
as
a community.
Yeah.
in any kind of way. And the weekend after that, we'll come back with Steve Daniels' exhibition and Jagger in the Mudroom.
Cool.
So we bumped that for a week. It's on now on the 17th of October. And he's doing these robotic light, shadow, sensory, small robot kind of things.
Cool.
And Anne's doing an exhibition in the back room around the history of hunting and the kind of culture around it with us sound and visual pieces. Yep.
So a lot of interesting multimedia installation stuff.
Yeah. Very a fibers show later on before the holidays.
Cool.
And we'll be doing a number of events end of November for listeners to stay tuned. A bunch of parties there.
Right. We'll keep everyone up on it.
Yeah.
And, of course, people can go to the ArtSpace website, artspace-arc.org, and we'll be keeping that up to date on what's happening as well. Cool. Any other thoughts that you'd like to put across today?
That's it. This is, I, you know, sincerely hope that everybody out there gets involved in what's happening right now to our country and our systems and our valuable communities.
Yeah.
And we've never necessarily been in this kind of drastic situation. So we've kind of all individually here on this end taken this to heart. And, you know, this, the bumping programming and focusing on, you know, Mr. Harper with installations, kind of a unique thing to be doing, just politically or socially in a community.
Yeah.
But we hope that it all agrees with our members. It's very important to us.
Yeah. Well, and this is where we've talked about this before, about trying to remain responsive to what's actually going on right now.
In a spectacular, fun, artistic way. This is why this community came together. It's you know, no citizen of this country is an ordinary Canadian. This is
we're all extraordinary
implication of issues, and we're so not understood and not heard, and where the rest of the people are doing and thinking, it just kind of boggles the mind.
Yep, it sure does. Okay, well, I'll let you go for this week.
Cool.
Thank you very much for filling us in.
Thanks, Wayne.
And we will undoubtedly be talking again over the next season, few weeks.
Absolutely.
Cool.
Very okay. Cool. Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.
All right. Okay. So that was Egogenic from down at the Art Space, filling us in on some of the activities happening around raising awareness about the funding cuts and what the implications are, and trying to come up with some strategies for combating this kind of assault on our creative community. Now, where should we go from here? You know, Pilot K9's here beside me.
I don't really know. I've just been jamming by myself until you came here.
Right.
I do have to be here apparently until 6:30.
Okay.
And well, the other shows have been preempted for to make way for me and my studio tour.
Right.
And I would have been able to do this tomorrow too if I had got my paperwork in on time. Taken care of it.
Yes, the bureaucracy is always there. It makes it all tick, 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 tick.
Well, it's not bureaucracy. It's not that kind of problem. It's the program director, the new guy, James Kerr. He didn't know I was going to be on the studio tour.
Oh, okay.
And like I discussed this starting in the spring when Laurel was still here.
Oh, yeah.
And in previous years, she's always been here, and I just assumed everything's fine. Everything's taken care of.
Just let it go, flow.
Yeah.
Well, and when I said bureaucracy, I didn't mean that in a big negative Kafkaesque way, but more in terms of, you know, paperwork helps to communicate and facilitate. And
well, yeah. James wasn't about to call up everyone on Sunday and say, look,
exactly.
Don't come in.
Yeah, no, exactly. But. Yeah.
Which is okay. It's going to make it easier for me because I don't even know what's happening in the kitchen where all my art is when I'm here in the studio.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I was thinking of that when I came in, that it you almost need an assistant to be guiding people.
It would be helpful. But
yeah. well, at any rate...
nothing's been stolen yet.
Nothing's been stolen, no. And I'm sure anybody coming through would probably know that it would be just really bad karma. At any rate, this weekend is the studio tour, which you can see signs all around Peterborough pointing your way around.
Yeah, and there are a lot outside of Peterborough, Lakefield, up by Stony Lake.
Right.
All over. Lindsay.
Where's the best starting point for somebody to get information and sort of start on into the tour from?
Well, there should be brochures available down at ArtSpace.
Mm-hmm.
There definitely will be at the Art Gallery of Peterborough.
Right.
There should be some at the library,
mm-hmm.
at the visitor center,
mm-hmm.
the tour center,
mm-hmm.
Which also has art by... various artists in the tour on display.
Oh, cool. So that's a good starting point.
That's a great starting point if you're coming into town.
Yeah, yeah, because you can get a look at where you might want to go. How many artists do you...
Just a minute. I'm going to go get one of the brochures.
Okay. Yeah, the studio tour tradition is quite interesting. Myself, I'm from up in the Bancroft area, and of course, there's a... studio tour that happens up there every fall, just like down here. I think that it's a really good way of showcasing where all the artists are in our community. I would encourage anybody that is not all that familiar with local artists to, go out and have a look around, because you might find some pleasant surprises along the way. We have a lot of incredibly talented folks. So now Brian's back here with the brochure, so he can let us know.
So here we go. Altogether are listed 28 artists.
Mm-hmm.
Leslie Givens and Bill Rowland in Millbrook, Anne Young in Emily. In Peterborough, we have Pierre Christensen, Rob Brown, Rowena Dykens, Catherine McIntosh Jeffrey, Wendy Trussler, John Klamenhag, Gail West, Scott Parker, Aaron Parker, Bronson Smith, Maura Joy Lustig, Patrick Fitzgerald, Brian Wagner, that's me,
mm-hmm.
and Jenny Johnson. In Lakefield are Stephanie Ford Forrester, Corin Ford Forrester, John Borman, and Christy Haldane. In Apsley, Molly Moldovan, Rosalind Reed, and Mary Kaner. In Warsaw, Thomas Aiken and Kate Hyde, Doug Andrews, and Anne Renouf.
Hmm.
In Keene, Lucy Manley. And Anne used to have a studio down on Hunter Street.
Yeah, that was. I was going to say that I recognize a good number of those names, but there was a lot that I didn't know too. That's very cool.
There's quite a few new artists this year.
Yeah, and it goes all the way up into Apsley. That's pretty cool. That's a nice spread, I'm sure that it's actually kind of a nice day for driving around, because it's kind of overcast and gray. And what else do you want to do but sort of drive around and look at beautiful things?
Well, the first 2 hours I was here, nobody showed up because it was raining. And in the downtown, people are mostly walking around.
Yeah. Whereas, like by the time you get out to Apsley and stuff, you'll probably see people are driving from place to place, because I doubt very much if they could walk from one studio to the next.
Biking, you could get to three or four of those places in a day.
Yeah. Yeah, the studio tour just wouldn't be long enough to get everyone in, I think. Like I was saying, as you went off to get the brochure, that this is a good time for folks to plug into who the local artists are in the area. Was
right.
One of the features that I really appreciated about years ago when I was in Bancroft, and people that would pop into. I used to help with my friend Jerry Kulis's studio, and people would pop in, had no idea who he was or that he even existed, and were amazed.
Is he the furniture maker?
No, he's he falls into the tradition of naive artist, self-taught.
Cool. Yeah.
Yeah. One of the particular traits of Jerry Kulis's paintings is he uses this blue-orange combination in these distinctly Ontario sunsets. I did not realize there was a distinct color until I seen him paint it, and now I can sort of see
it. Now you know what it is.
Now I see, because I noticed that a lot of other sunsets have more reds, and there's just right. there's a certain tonal quality that is very Ontario. So, and
well, I especially like the light this time of year.
Yeah. Yes.
Like mid-afternoon is just beautiful if the sun is shining.
Yeah. Well, and even when it is sort of overcast, depending on how thick the overcast is, when you don't get the direct light, you get these, you know, especially with the trees and stuff, these brilliant colors.
Right.
Because when it's full sun, there's a lot of light, but your pupils dilate and you can't see as much.
So, right.
As you probably aware with doing camera work.
Yeah. Well, you know, on an overcast day, like today.
Yeah.
It depends, but sometimes I get really saturated colors.
Yeah. No, exactly. You get these really, because you don't have those hot points.
Right.
That the direct sunlight.
You don't
makes.
Have the contrast and.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, the digital will compensate for that to some extent.
Yes. Yeah.
I've been telling people I'd like to get back into 35mm photography because I've hardly touched my camera since I got the digital 4 years ago.
Right. To be honest, I many years ago gave away my 35mm camera because I still have 10 rolls of undeveloped, or, you know, shot but undeveloped film.
Yeah, I got some of that stuff, too.
Unfortunately, I'm between digital cameras right now. But earlier today, I was on Facebook. And Lester had uploaded some photographs that he had recently taken. Beautiful photography and using old school, the analog. And a mutual friend of ours commented how she was very, it brought her back to what the non-digital sort of photography looked like. And she realized that it, when she was shooting with a film camera, she would look at things differently.
Yeah.
The way that she was, you know, putting together the colors and the form and stuff, it just would strike her eye in a different way. Then she was thanking Lester because she hadn't really thought about it for a while, and then seeing these pictures sort of brought it all back to her.
It is. I kind of noticed that when I've got my binder of 35mm photos and on the computer I've got the digital.
Yep. Yep. I think that there's strengths in both. I mean, the biggest strength in digital, of course, is that it's cheap once you get the camera. In that, you know, there's you don't have all those developing costs and stuff.
It's almost free.
Yeah, yeah, no, exactly. That being said, their film definitely has a very distinct quality to it.
If I'm doing something for blow up, like a 12 by 18 inch size. Definitely, I would be using 35mm.
Yep. Yeah, because it's got the grain to it. It's got that extra grain to it. That it's analog. So, in other words, there's no discrete kind of levels with digital. It's chopped up into blocks in that kind of way.
Yeah, you could see that if you blew up. Well, my camera is 3.1 megapixels.
Yep.
Which is, by today's standards, that's not. Not
yeah,
really
that's pretty low res, dude.
Well, for the same price, I could probably get one that's 9.5 megapixels or 12.3 or something like that.
Yeah. Hey, my old camera was a 1.3, so.
Yeah, 1.3.
Hey, it did the trick, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Actually, one of the things that I really enjoyed with the digital photography is being able to do things like panoramas and things like that, which you can do with film, but not as easily. Because with a digital camera, you can go out and shoot hundreds of pictures on a, you know, single card.
Right. 156 on my card.
Yeah.
Although my card was misplaced for a while, and I had to replace it with an old chip that only held 9 images.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, man, that was frustrating.
Yep, that would. But, yeah, like you can do these, you know, multiple takes without having to worry about having to get multiple rolls of film developed.
Yeah, when I think back to the hundreds and thousands of dollars I spent on developing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's an expensive route to go. At one point, I did some darkroom lessons with a woman, and I have to say that I found it quite enjoyable, and it's a very interesting process.
Yeah.
Some pretty nasty chemicals involved, but. We were doing black and white, and it was fun, and it allows you to really hold on to the image in a really physical way when you're going through that process. There's something very tactile. It's, you know, because it's a physical thing. It's not, you know, in the computer digital cybersphere where everything's slightly ethereal.
Yeah, but you can also modify the image in various ways.
Yeah.
Like what the enlarger does is projects the negative onto print paper.
Mm-hmm.
And I've known people who would do things like my friend Bart.
Mm-hmm.
He did things like he would dip his hand in the developer.
Oh yeah.
And then put a handprint on the paper, and that's the only part that would develop.
Right.
You see an image of whatever it was in the shape of his hand.
Right. Yeah, there was an artist, I cannot remember his name, there was a, I don't know if it's still going, a literary magazine called The Sun, and this artist did a remarkable number of the covers, and would do these kind of like in the dark room photo montages that rivaled what people do with Photoshop. Just spectacular stuff. And he did it all in the dark room using, you know, masking and multiple projections onto
I would like to see
paper.
That.
Yeah, it's some gorgeous, gorgeous stuff. My guess is that if I could remember his name and you saw one of his images, you go, oh, that guy.
Right.
Because there was a period in the early 90s when it was not just the Sun. That was, he did a lot of those covers, but he also did a lot of work with the Utna Reader and those types of publications. And, again, one of those kind of artists where the images kind of like get imprinted into your subconscious, and then years later you go, oh,
that guy.
That guy. It's now I've lost where I'm going to go with that. We were just talking about cameras and stuff, but
do you remember when the newspapers first started accepting digital photos?
No. Well, I was up in Bancroft, where I'm not even sure they accept them yet. But
Now.
Sorry.
When people first got cheap digital cameras, and they were everywhere, and they were fine if you want to look at them on your computer screen.
Right.
Email them to your grandma or whatever.
Yeah.
But if you print it out, they looked like crap.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they were made of Lego.
Yeah, because they were that super low resolution. I was mentioning my 1.3 megapixel camera, which is this old, ancient Olympus digital, and I have two versions of it. I had one, and a friend borrowed it and accidentally broke it, but he actually, at home, he's from the States, and so when he went back down home, he had an older version of the same camera, and he sent it to me. And it's very funny because this really old one, I think it probably would have been manufactured around 97, 98. And it actually takes about 30 seconds to save a picture.
To save a picture?
To save a picture. So you take a picture and then you have to wait like about 30 seconds or more for it to save the image. But the image was only 1.3 megapixels. So it was like...
That must be frustrating.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, that's part of the reason why I haven't really been using that camera. That said, I actually have plans for both those cameras. One of the unique features about it is that it actually has a composite video output, so you could actually plug this thing into your TV and see what's coming through the lens real time.
My camera has that as well.
So what I'd like to do is take these two cameras, mount them, and create a stereoscopic video camera by using the two cameras and getting a little video mixer to put the left and right images side by side.
Interesting.
Yep. And then, you know, one of the things that always blows me away with stereoscopic photography is just how underutilized it is. Going back to, however you pronounce his name, I say Muybridge. How do you pronounce it?
I call him My Bridge.
My Bridge. At any rate, there's all those vowels in the first part of his name, so it's kind of... At any rate, he did extensive stereoscopes from, you know, all across the continental U.S. Gorgeous stuff.
Geez, I didn't know that he'd done a lot of that.
Oh, yeah.
I know his motion studies.
Yeah.
They're one of the most overused images in all of art of the 20th century.
It's true. Sad but true. But if you go online and go searching, there's a few different archives of his work. He did this massive series of stereoscopes, and a lot of them were cataloging the national forests. So they were they're these gorgeous stereoscopic, so 3D images of the national forests all across the U.S. going back to, like, what, the late 1800s he was doing that stuff? Yeah. Which is, and like I said, they're gorgeous. They're quite stunning. It was fairly common also in the penny arcades. There were the little, what do they call those things where you turn the handle and you see the animation?
Kinescopes,
yeah, like that. Which they were just kind of a mechanical version of film, where they had a little flippy thing on the inside, and you turn the crank, and it would flip the images and give you an animation. But there was a great number of those that were in 3D, that were done stereoscopically.
Oh, I didn't know that. I know that there were, there were a bunch of different models.
Yeah.
Rival companies developing.
Yeah. And at one point it was, you know. It's just like a lot of technologies where in the initial stages there's this kind of explosion of various directions that then seem to narrow down after a while, and some of the best ideas just get left by the wayside.
Well, one catches on with consumers. That can happen.
Yep.
Or somebody might have a superior model but just be terrible at business.
Yep.
That happens a lot.
Well, there's also some nefarious things where...
If anyone developed a really good one, Thomas Edison would send his goons around to smash the thing up.
Right. And in point of fact, I do remember back in the late 80s when I was in college in a trade magazine seeing the early digital conversion kits that would fit into your 35 millimeter. And it just had a plate that would go over where the film would normally go.
Right.
And it had, you know, sort of the electronics in a canister shape so that it would fit right into your 35 millimeter and allow you to take digital pictures with your 35 millimeter camera.
Those were pretty expensive.
Right.
Journalists would use them.
But yeah, but they disappeared fast. You'll notice that they're not really around. But it's just one of those technologies that kind of slips by. Because, I mean, part of the thing, my suspicion is that the manufacturers of digital cameras wanted people to move over to fully digital cameras. So
well, a lot of them are the same companies. Like
exactly.
Nikon used to have the broadest range of cameras of any company any company in the world.
Yep.
And now they've got two single lens reflex cameras.
Right.
Just two.
Yeah. Well, and you see, I think that this is where, you know, it's that kind of like, trying to force people to move into a new product, right?
Right. Because, well, if you've already got a big investment in good camera gear, like optics, especially, is...
That is actually one of the keys to digital photography, is a camera with good optics. That's really what determines a good from a bad camera.
But the optics are a lot cheaper in the cameras, too, because they can be so much smaller.
Yeah. Yes. Well, like I was going to mention that those Olympus models that I have, the lenses in them are actually quite good. The images that I get, they might be low resolution, but there's, you know, certain quality to the picture that is quite pleasing.
Right.
In contrast to some of the cheaper or, you know, other...
Right, the ones where you get chromatic aberration, it's called.
Oh,
I love
yes.
that word.
Yeah.
You get a little... red and blue halos around things.
Oh, yeah.
Because the different wavelengths of light don't bend equally.
Right.
In this cheap, single-piece, probably plastic lens.
Right. Yes. Well, and that's, as you're describing, I was like, oh, that's what's going on. Okay, that makes sense. Because, yeah, no, I can see the difference. I mean, you know, I had friends with, you know, cheaper cameras and kind of go, ew. now, the other thing that I've noticed, too, is that there's a lot of the cheaper cameras tend to use heavy compression on the images. And that's another thing that JPEG compression can just kill a picture. That's where things get this kind of squarey blurriness. But also you'll, like in clouds, you'll, or blue sky, you'll get that blockiness.
Right, right.
Yep, that's from JPEG compression. Yeah. Because of the way it's quantifying the pixels and the
right. So then if you want it to look good, you have to modify it in Photoshop.
Yeah, but
with
even then,
a Gaussian blur or something.
Yeah, and even then, you know, you're using a Gaussian blur, so you're losing detail. And there's some products out there on the market that are specifically designed for fixing up digital images like that, but I've yet to see one that really does the job.
Yeah.
As
well,
an old friend of mine used to say, you can't make a silk purse out of a sow's ear.
Well, my camera with the 256 meg chip will hold 156 photos at the maximum resolution,
right?
Which is 2048 by 1400,
nice.
1500 pixels,
cool.
Something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But at the lowest, like screen resolution, 72 DPI.
Yeah.
I think you can hold over 2,000.
Yeah. Yeah, no, the difference in size is quite phenomenal.
But they'd be so badly compressed, I wouldn't even care to look at them on a screen very much.
Yeah. Well, and that comes back to what you were saying before about, you know, it's great for sending, you know, pictures of the grandkids to the grandparents on the computer through email. And in point of fact, you actually want to... here's a lesson in netiquette, people. Do not send huge pictures to people. Unless it's specifically for print. But I've gotten that before where somebody's sending me a snapshot and it's, you know, 5 meg.
yeah, that can happen.
Which back in the old days when I was on dial-up was just frustrating. Well, at any rate, shall we move into some sound stuff?
All right.
And then we can pick up next week, talk about some more art and noise.
Okay. Is there another meeting like the one you were discussing with Iga? Is there another meeting?
Not immediately planned. In terms of it's just going to be kind of ongoing stuff. As she was saying, there's the 30-second film thing that people are working on where they're submitting these 30-second films about these arts cuts and stuff like that. And that's going to be ongoing at ArtSpace.
Right. Are they all about the arts cuts?
Not sure. That's what we were talking about, and that it particularly... it. Sounded like what Iga was mainly focused on is trying to get encourage people to do things to raise awareness and do it, as she said, in a way that's not, you know, all heavy and doom and gloom, but, you know, has some
With a 30-second film you can have a lot of fun.
That's right. And you can have fun and make a point at the same time. And in point of fact, you usually make a better point when you have at least a little bit of humor in there.
Yeah.
So, have you got some sounds? Well, it looks like I see some bars fluctuating, so I'm assuming that there's some sound running
got,
through.
I've got a few things playing.
Okay.
If you just fade that up, let's see what we've got.
Okay. Now, before I get it completely overwhelming us and fade us right out, just to get you to kind of... say a word or two on your process here in terms of generating noise.
The process. Well,
yeah.
This is really fun. I've tried out I don't know how many different software packages for doing live mixing.
Mm-hmm.
And none of them are perfect.
Yeah.
They all have great things that are great about them, but they're all lacking some feature that I really, really want.
Yeah, or there are those ones that have that one really great feature. Everything else about it sucks, but there's that one thing.
I've got a few of those too. So what I've done is when John Muir showed me the FC Mixer,
mm-hmm.
what I do is I've got Winamp, which is a free download, mm-hmm. A media player. It'll play audio, video, in just about any format.
Mm-hmm.
The mixer, FC Mixer, allows you to open three of them at a time, mm-hmm. And then I've got three little faders here to control each of them from one small panel.
Nice.
Right. It's also got an automatic crossfade feature. You can pan left to right.
Mm-hmm.
You can start, stop, and pause them from the control panel.
Mm-hmm. Now, on top of that, you've also got on each of these three open Winamps various effects going as well.
They all have the equalizer.
Uh-huh.
That it's like a supersonic treble and bass controls.
Yeah.
Instead of just being sort of vaguely labeled treble and bass, they're divided into what is it? 2, 4, 6, 8, 10 frequency ranges.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So you can actually shape the sound.
Nice. Which allows you to take, you know, the three different signals and sort of slot them in around each other.
Right. If you change the EQ on them, then you can mix them and they don't interfere with each other so much. They don't start to get muddy.
Yeah.
Which is a big problem when you're using a lot of sources.
Yeah. And then you've also got the, with Winamp itself, it has its own kind of internal, the Nullsoft Signal Processing Studio.
Yeah, that's built in. You go to the options menu, DSP, and it has a collection of them built in.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them are actually kind of simple, and but there is a delay with feedback.
Mm-hmm.
There's a loop sampler, resolution reduction,
right,
which chops your sound into. It can make it pretty rough sounding.
Yep.
CD quality sound normally has a bit depth of 16, which gives you what 65,000 discrete volume levels.
Yeah.
And yeah, it can turn it into sounding like a telephone.
Yeah.
Reverseness, which will cut up pieces of the MP3 up to 4 seconds long.
Hello.
And play them in reverse.
Right.
It doesn't play the whole MP3 in reverse. Which
no,
is too
that
bad.
Would. Yeah, I mean, there's things you could do to do that, but that's yeah.
But I like using the reverseness on the stream from Guelph.
Oh yeah.
And you can even do it on a live stream.
Right.
You can use any of these effects.
Right. Which is because you're using Winamp, and Winamp will play, you know, local files on your hard drive, but it'll also play streaming URLs as well.
Right.
Which is, as you were mentioning, the down in Guelph, there's the Porter Hall and...
At CFRU.
At CFRU. So you're able to take his stream, pull it in, affect it, mix it, send it back
send
to him.
Send it back out. Yeah, and since there's a delay in digitizing it each time, we don't have the possibility of feedback like you could with when you wave a telephone at the radio.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
Although Porter Hall does manage to get feedback somehow. I don't know how he does it.
Oh, Parker has just noticed some of the fancy new equipment here in the Trent Radio.
Yeah, he's excited. We're all excited.
We're very excited. Which you should mention, you've got some Bukowski thrown into the mix here.
On CD2, yeah. He's also turned down -16% speed.
Oh, okay.
So well, he's going to sound like actually, he's going to sound terrible.
He's on CD2,
yes.
So I can actually pull that up a little bit.
Not too much,
wow.
Just a little.
So
kill a horse in the street.
Wow.
But there aren't any.
Yeah, this new CD player is actually a DJ deck.
Okay.
It's in two parts, rack mount. Fits a standard 19-inch rack, but the one rack has the two CD players, and the other has the control units.
Right.
So the start stop. It also plays MP3 CDs.
Yeah.
So you put 10, 12 times as much stuff. Wherever you go.
Yeah. And I'm noticing that on this machine it's got loop in, loop out, pitch. Oh man, it's quite the nifty little
Yeah, yeah, it's got a big slider that goes to plus or minus 16% speed.
Right.
Or if you double click, it'll be 8% and give you a lot finer resolution.
Right.
And you can loop a section.
Mm-hmm.
Just tap the loop in.
Yep.
And when you want it to end, loop out, and it'll loop continuously.
Right. Cool. That's some nifty new fun. So I'm imagining that this new season of... now, your show... Are you still doing the show on Tuesday nights?
Yes, I am.
And that is...
Praying Mantra. At 10 o'clock.
Uh-huh. And then your show on Saturdays...
Dog Bites Manlisher is right. 3 to 4 on Saturdays.
Right. So I'm imagining that with this nifty new equipment, there's going to be some kind of groovy new sounds coming through.
Oh, yeah.
Well, that's cool. We've actually managed to fill in an hour of chatting away. First with Iga, all about art space and various arts coming togethers. Talked a bit about noise. And guess what? Next week, we're going to be back, and we'll do more of the same.
Okay.
So, as promised, we will send you back into some Pilot K9, and see you all next week. Bye.
She had to go and tell the authorities.